WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
I got an invitation to a show at one of San Francisco's Tonier Art Galleries. A very classy piece of work, at least up to the announcement at the bottom, the gallery shall remain open until 8 p.m. on Thursday evenings. That probably wasn't what they meant, not unless the extended hours were required by law. What they meant to say was the gallery will remain open, but they tried to gild the frame and wound up with that most embarrassing of slips, the bungled Anglicism. The distinction between shall and will is the flower of what H.W. Fowler used to call the English of the English, but the rules are as tangled and thorny as an English bramble. For one thing, the meaning of shall and will changes according to the subject. You shall expresses an obligation or makes a promise. You will makes a simple prediction. If an Englishman tells you, you shall have your money, he means that he's going to pay you. But if he says, you will have your money, you can whistle for it. But in the first person, the meanings are reversed. Here it's I shall that makes the prediction, and I will that expresses promise or determination. The difference is summed up in the old story about a Frenchman foundering in the surf off Brighton who yells, help, I will drown, and no one shall save me, so nobody does. But it isn't only foreigners who have trouble with shall and will. The Scots and Irish don't bother with the distinction, a point that the English have historically taken as a clear indication of the mental deficiencies of the Celtic races. And in America, the English use of shall has never really taken root outside New England. As James Thurber wrote, men who use shall west of the Appalachians are the kind who twirl canes and eat lady fingers. Granted, it's a charming distinction, but Americans are bound to screw it up. Even General Douglas MacArthur got it wrong when he announced his intention to recapture the Philippines by saying, I shall return, where it was, I will return, that really expresses the determination he had in mind. It's not the kind of thing you can pick up in the course of a junior year abroad. As the 19th century Bostonian writer Richard Grant White put it, the distinction is too subtle for persons who have not had the advantage of early intercourse with educated English people, English in blood and breeding. But then, why would any self-respecting American want to touch this business with a barge pole? When I hear an American reaching for a shall, it puts me in mind of the flap that was raised a couple of years ago when a White House protocol officer was photographed curtsying to Queen Elizabeth. As one critic commented, we fought a war about that. Maybe Thomas Jefferson and Noah Webster were right when they suggested that we should have thrown the King's English over the side along with a king and called our language American or federal or some such thing. Then nobody would be tempted to assume that the English own the language just because it's named after them, and we might have been spared this game of linguistic upstairs-downstairs that's gone on 200 years too long. I like to believe that hell has its own American quarter, with a special circle set aside for Anglophiles, though of course they call it a roundabout. At its center is a cozy pub where one can park one's motor car, loosen one's braces, and chat over the controversies of the day, with one's legs crossed like Alistair Cook and one's Filofax in one's lap. But for everything that comes out of your mouth, you pay the price in what goes into it. For the place serves nothing but English food. You spend eternity drinking warm lager and eating fish and chips wrapped in grease-sodden newspapers, English newspapers still wet from the presses, so that you can read about Di and Fergie on every piece of cod.